You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, British Columbia. We strive to provide perspectives that are rarely expressed in mainstream media. If you'd like to know more about us, check out our website at cjsf.ca.
New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions.
This hour, we'll be exploring the nature of creativity, what it means to be creative, how we can be creative, and what can get in our way of being creative. Dr. Eric Mizell is a licensed family therapist, a creativity coach, and author of more than 40 books. He also conducts writing workshops. His books include Natural Psychology, The New Psychology of Meaning, and Life Purpose Bootcamp, the 8-week breakthrough plan for creating a meaningful life. Join us for the next hour as we explore the nature of creativity with our guest, Dr. Eric Mizell. I'm Roger Houston, and I'll be your host. Welcome to New Dimensions. Eric Mizell, welcome.
Hello, Roger. Great to be with you.
This really is a delight because what a wonderful subject to spend an hour speaking on creativity. And I imagine what a wonderful occupation it must be to be a creativity coach.
If my clients do their work, then it's a wonderful occupation. But as you know, it's often hard to get our creative work done. So I'm working with folks who get stuck, who have difficulties with the marketplace, who have emotional ups and downs. So the work is indeed wonderful, but not necessarily easy.
Now, how did you begin your life as a creativity coach?
Well, the long story is I started as a little science boy when I was young. I thought I would be in science, but then I discovered I only liked the metaphors of science, not actually doing calculus and physics. After I got out of the Army, I got one of those degrees that one gets when one doesn't know what to do, and that was a degree in philosophy. But then I started writing my first novel when I was 24. I realized, or it came upon me, that I was going to be a writer. That didn't pan out in terms of dollars. I wrote excellent books, but wasn't able to support a family on that. So I retooled as a therapist in my early 30s, became a California licensed marriage and family therapist, and decided to work exclusively with creative and performing artists. I was interested in their issues, my issues. And I don't think anyone was working with artists specifically back then. This was before famous books like The Artist's Way and what have you came out. This was sort of a new occupation. Then very rapidly, I realized I didn't like the therapy model. I didn't believe I was dealing with mental disorders, but rather with the problems of living that creative people face. So I segued out of therapy to something I called creativity consulting, because at that time, coaching hardly existed. This is quite a while ago. And then when coaching became a popular word, then I moved from creativity consulting to creativity coaching. And that's what I've been doing for 20 or 25 years now.
So it's interesting that you started out as wanting at least to be a novelist. And found it a challenge in terms of the marketplace. And that really makes me wonder, you know, whether you feel that creative endeavor of that kind, that is of the artistic kind, is possible for everyone, or is it what traditionally we think of as creativity really being something reserved for the special few?
I think there's a sense in which a person can be, let's call it, everyday creative and make their pumpkin soup more creatively or do this or that more creatively. In fact, I think creativity has become that stand-in word for the human potential movement. I think we talked about human potential in one way in the 60s and 70s. And now I think creativity becomes the kind of word that stands for manifesting potential. So we all want to manifest potential. So I think everyone can be creative in that sense. Now, the difference is when you self-identify as an artist, when you decide that you're in one of those disciplines, whether it's dance or poetry or film writing or what have you, then you take on all of the obligations and difficulties of that discipline. And something very different changes then. A, you have to work in a form. You can't be just everyday creative. You actually have to finish a book or finish a film. You have to work in a form, and then you have to sell the thing. And so that's not really everybody's specialité to both finish large projects and then sell those projects. Anybody can be an everyday creative person. I think it takes a special set of, whether to call it skills or personality traits or motivational places in one, to become the kind of creative person who does big work and manages to sell that work.
You spoke of the human potential movement and creativity being really at the foundation of that. But I wonder what you might see as the difference, if you do see any difference, between self-expression and creativity.
Well, creativity has three definitions, typically. One is innovation, one is problem solving, and one is manifesting potential. In the business world, when we talk about creativity in business, which is a catchphrase, that's typically about problem solving and innovation. But I think the kind of creativity that you and I are talking about is the manifesting potential creativity. And it's really not so easy to do. It sounds easy to do. When you're 5 years old, you know how to scratch out a drawing, and maybe you enjoy your drawing, and maybe your parents put your drawing up on the refrigerator. But that's not the grown-up finished work. It doesn't put us in the lineage that we want to be in, because I think creative folks of the sort we're talking about fall in love with a discipline early on. They fall in love with reading a book or seeing a film or hearing music. 5 or 6 or 7, you're the kid sitting in the corner reading a book no matter what's going on around you. So you've fallen in love with something and now you're in a lineage. And you want to be, whatever your lineage is, whether it's Jane Austen or Dostoevsky or whatever your lineage is, you want your place at that table. So you've set the bar very high. It's not just manifesting potential. It's really to be excellent-great. And that's not so easy to do. If it were just about expressing oneself, well, everybody who sends an email in a certain sense expresses themselves. We're setting the bar much higher than that when we talk about creativity.
I think we are, because really creativity points to something, some dimension that is involved, that is beyond our ordinary personality, that is beyond our familiar sense of self. And self-expression, I think, tends to be the expression of our familiar identity. So I think there is a difference there. And I like that you pointed to, you know, the childhood and earlier times in our lives as being an indicator of whether that nascent potential might be there or not in a particular individual. I mean, the word genius, for example, comes, as you know, from the Roman, the Latin, really meaning a tutelary deity or guiding spirit. And there's another question, you know, does everybody have a guiding spirit, or is a guiding spirit, that is a genius, really the reserve of a special few?
Well, if by guiding spirit you mean something external to us, I'm an activist atheist, so I probably don't believe in guiding spirit in one sense. I believe that we don't get our brain quiet enough usually to do good work. or to have good thoughts bubble up. And so the way I would say it is most people's brains are quite noisy, what Buddhists would call monkey mind. And when that happens, every thought grabs neurons. That's what a thought is. So most folks are having their billions of neurons grabbed by virtue of thinking one small thought and another small thought. I think what a creative person can do, part of a creative person's brilliance, is even if their mind is noisy here and there, they manage to quiet it in the service of having ideas bubble up. There's a way in which they go into the trance of working, go into flow, whatever language you want to call it, they get quiet. And it's out of that quietness, and whether that's guiding spirit or what have you, I still think it's their own brain, so to speak. It's their own brain, and very often they can't get quiet when they want to. They can't order up quietness. So they may have to sit there and preamble in noise. They may have to sit there in a noisy, their own noisy inner environment until they can settle. Sort of like if you shake up a snow globe. I think most of us are like shaking snow globes, and then we have to settle ourselves in order for good ideas to bubble up.
I think so, absolutely, yes. You know, another word from the Greek is the muse, of course, and people often speak, whether it's figuratively or literally in their mind, about having a muse. And you said, by the way, that you were an atheist. And for me, the notion of guiding spirit doesn't necessarily mean some external spirit, but it certainly does mean a deeper dimension of my own humanity. And I think that is also true with the notion of muse. But muse actually originally meant to reflect, to muse, to reflect upon, to ponder, to wonder. So that really connects with what you're saying about the quiet mind.
It does. And I offer up clients what I call ceremonial bridges into that quietness. Because, as I say, we're noisy generally. We're not just noisy. Let me make a side point. All day long, we're supposed to get things right. That's the way we're supposed to be in the world. We're supposed to drive on the correct side of the road and pick up our kids at 3 and make sure the garden is weeded and just do things right. And then somehow a moment is supposed to come where we have real permission to make mistakes and messes. So that's what the creative process is. It's real permission, not just intellectual permission, but whole body, visceral permission to go try to write a novel for 2 years that may turn out to be a mess. It's not easy to get that permission from oneself to spend that many good hours on something that may not work out. That's why I think we need a ceremonial bridge into getting quiet. And one of the bridges I suggest is just deep breathing, 5 seconds on the inhale, 5 seconds on the exhale, and saying, I'm completely stopping, meaning I'm completely stopping my need to get things right.
I think people will love hearing that. I mean, the message that it's actually not necessary to get things right all the time, I think can be really quite liberating. And what you're also pointing to is the value of limit. That is the value of limitation, our own limitations. How limitation can actually serve us. People write sonnets. Now, a sonnet is a very specific, limited form of poetry. Why do people do that? Why limit themselves in that way? Because the limit actually somehow opens up a capacity for freedom. I think that's what you're speaking to.
And also, limits deal with the problem of fragmentation. Many of my clients have thousands upon thousands of notes and ideas and what have you. Until they name a thing, they're stuck.
I'm speaking with Dr. Eric Maisel, author of Life Purpose Bootcamp, the 8-week breakthrough plan for creating a meaningful life. If you'd like to know more about the work of Dr. Maisel, you can go to his website, ericmaisel.com. That's Eric, E-R-I-C, Maisel, M-A-I-S-E-L.com. Or you can get there on the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Roger Houston, and you're listening to New Dimensions. I'm speaking with Dr. Eric Mizell, author of Life Purpose Bootcamp, the 8-week breakthrough plan for creating a meaningful life. Eric, before the break, we were speaking about limits and beginning to speak of the value of limits, actually. And I was reminded of an artist called Phil Hansen, who developed nerve damage and a shaky hand from so much concentrative work on the pointillist style, you know, painting a picture with tiny dots. And so what did he do? He embraced the shake. I love that. He actually started using larger scale canvases and bigger materials, and he started dipping his feet in paint and walking on the canvas. And then he decided to use just $1 worth of supplies. So what he is showing us with that is that our limitations can actually drive our creativity. Sounds counterintuitive, doesn't it? But I think they can. And I'm sure you must have experienced this many times with your clients.
The example I always use is Matisse, when arthritis overtook him, moving to paper cutouts and making collages, which then became world famous. And he had to deal with limitations and change. It's actually an oddity. It's interesting to me how many artists have to deal with chronic pain, all sorts of disabilities that force them to, A, figure out how to do their art with that chronic pain, but B, also how to organize their day around their limitations.
Yes.
I spend a lot of time with artist clients helping them actually just organize their day because, as you know, most artists often need a day job. They have other responsibilities in life. And one of their complaints is that they can't get to their work. So I advise them to institute a morning creativity practice. I think for a lot of artists, it's imperative that they carve out this extra hour before their real day starts to get their creative work done, that they then not scorn small increments of time during the day if 20 minutes arises here or 20 minutes arises there, to make use of that. In other words, to spend the day very mindfully in the understanding that they may not get their creative work done if they're not better organized than most human beings are, because they're trying to do so many things in life, namely earn a living to the right and also do great creative work to the left. And that requires a lot of old-fashioned scheduling, planning, routines. Those, I think, are rather sacred words in an artist's life, things like routine and regularity, because it's necessary.
It is necessary, absolutely, yes. What would you say to someone who comes to you and says, you know, I don't know why, I mean, I want to write, but I don't think anyone's going to want to read what I say. No one's why should anyone listen to me? Or why should anyone actually look at my paintings more than anybody else's? There are thousands of artists and writers out there. What difference is my voice going to make?
I have different kinds of answers to that. The first kind of answer is a cognitive answer. That's not a thought that serves you. You need to take charge of your thoughts better than that. As the Buddha said, get a grip on your mind. It's not serving you to say something like, I wonder if my art ultimately matters, or I wonder if anyone will be interested. Because we're not really looking at the truth or falsity of a thought, but rather whether the thought serves you, which is a different idea. Your thought may be true, so to speak. Maybe 27 million people will not read your short story. That may be a true thought, but that may not be a thought that serves you to think that no one will be interested. So there's the cognitive answer of really trying to think thoughts that serve you and identifying those kinds of thoughts as thoughts that don't serve you. And then there's the existential answer, which is you have to decide to matter. One of the things I'm interested in is the paradigm shift from seeking meaning to making meaning, the idea that meaning is not out there somewhere at the top of a mountain or at some guru's feet, but rather there's a subjective psychological experience. If you want the subjective psychological experience of meaning, if you want life to feel meaningful, you have to do those things that provoke that experience. And if for you one of those things is writing or painting or singing or what have you, then you are doing it not just to make a thing, not just to have a performance, you're doing it so that you can have the experience of meaning. And there's hardly anyone who doesn't think that the experience of meaning is a valuable thing.
So we're speaking really there of where the motivation for your creative process comes from, aren't we, in the sense of, you were speaking earlier of, again, in childhood, of people having a natural tendency towards one particular form or another and following that. So it's not an idea that's being imposed upon a person from the outside necessarily, by either by their parents or by their own mind, but a natural arising that they actually then have the discipline to follow.
It's a natural arising, and it also can run its course. It can also not necessarily be the thing that you now do 40 years later. That's why I tell clients that they need a menu of meaning opportunities. They need multiple life purpose choices. Rather than getting stuck in that singular framework of I have one life purpose or there is one meaning to life, I think it's very important that folks come to the idea of a menu of such possibilities. Because let's say that you fell in love with dance when you were five, and now you've had your two hip transplants, and you can't really be the dancer you had meant to be. That better not mean that you can't have meaning in your life. That had better not mean that you can't have creativity in your life. That's why you need to know the other things that may also provoke the experience of meaning and that might also satisfy your creative urge. Folks find that very difficult to move from that primary place of meaning, that still being a dancer, that identity piece of being a dancer, to even being able to broach some other idea about what to try now. It's one of the things I have to help clients with, and it's very painful for clients to open up to the possibility that X has actually run its course, and now it's time for Y.
Well, of course, it's a shift of identity, and that's why it's painful, because, you know, it's really asking you to let go of a familiar sense of self and to open, actually to open to the unknown.
To open to the unknown and to let go of multiple dreams and aspirations and hopes, those are powerful things. There are a few writers who haven't already prepared their Nobel Prize-winning speech, or actors who haven't accepted their Academy Award in their mind. People have dreams for themselves, and those dreams are finally over when you say to yourself, I can no longer do this thing, I have to do the next thing. So yes, you're losing the identity piece, but you're also closing the door on long-held dreams, and that's another very painful place.
Absolutely, yes. You know, I'm reminded again, actually, of Matisse, who you mentioned a few moments ago, because although he stayed broadly within the same field of painting, the way he painted changed every few years, and dramatically. You know, he was one of the primary fauve painters at one period, 1905, 1906, something like that. And yet, 30, 40 years later, he was cutting paper cutouts, you know, and we have that wonderful series on jazz. And then the very end of his life, what did he do? Not painting at all. He designed a chapel. And for Matisse, that chapel, which is in Vence in Provence, that chapel, he said, was the summation of his life's work, and yet it had nothing. It apparently had nothing to do with everything else. So I think he's a wonderful example of someone who's willing to change horses, partly because of necessity, in his case, health.
And because he can deal with the anxiety of change. One of the ways we learn to deal with anxiety is to repeat ourselves. If we've discerned how to do a certain kind of stripe painting, and now we know that we can produce that same stripe painting with thinner stripes or different colors, we know exactly how to do that, then we no longer provoke any anxiety in ourselves, and the creative process has gotten calm, but unfortunately, mechanically calm, and we don't get to grow. So it's one of the, repeating ourselves is one of the traps of the creative person. I think you were speaking exactly to someone who refused to be caught in that trap. There's the apocryphal story of the great Japanese painters who at certain points in their career would burn all of their previous work so as not to be held hostage by what they had done previously. And it's a brilliant idea, but how many people can actually deal, A, with the loss of probably a lot of good work, but also the anxiety of truly going into the unknown, not into some fake unknown, just some rhetorical unknown, but the real unknown of not knowing what you're doing next.
I'm reminded again of the Tibetans who spend weeks creating a sand mandala only at the end to dissolve the whole thing. And what that's saying, of course, is that there is a degree of detachment between the artist in that case and the piece of work, that in some way, even though you're pouring everything into it, there's also a letting go.
That's right. And the, I say it in two different ways. One is that you want to show up and not attach to outcomes, that the main work is showing up. And then I also say that there's a dance of attachment and detachment, because I think that there is some attachment necessary, too. I think we're really investing ourselves in the enterprise. We're throwing ourselves into it. I think we want to care. I think we want it to be important to us. I think we want it to matter, comma. And then we also want to know how to detach and when to detach. One of the difficulties the creative folks face is finishing things. They get to the 98% place, and then the specter of having to show it in the world, having to sell it, getting pushback, getting criticism, getting rejection, all of that prevents them from actually saying, I'm done, even though the piece may be done. This is another place where a creative person has to understand the necessary detachment that's required of them, because if they don't detach from that piece, they can spend 15 years on their memoir, changing a word here, changing a word there, so as to not have to experience rejection or any problems in the marketplace. But that means they don't get to move on to something else wonderful and interesting.
Although it may also be that they're such perfectionists that they can never stop. You know, in French, there's a word called bonarding from the French painter Bonnard, who is, for me, one of the greatest painters of all time. But Bonnard used to creep into the museums where his paintings were exhibited to add one more touch to the painting. He couldn't let go of it, you know. That's a different...
I think many collectors have experienced that problem, the danger of having the artist come over and see the painting on the wall and have to tie the painter's arms down so that he doesn't change the painting on the wall. It's a not uncommon feeling, because we change. Even our eyesight may change. What we thought was, what was red to us, what was a certain crimson 10 years ago, may be a different hue today. So that's one of the problems is finishing work and allowing it to be.
I'm speaking with Dr. Eric Mizell, author of Life Purpose Bootcamp, the 8-week breakthrough plan for creating a meaningful life. If you'd like to know more about the work of Dr. Mizell, you can go to his website, ericmizell.com. That's Eric, E-R-I-C, Mizell, M-A-I-S-E-L.com. Or you can get there on the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Roger Houston, and you're listening to New Dimensions.
New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter hour